We have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
You're listening to Hard Facts, the show that gets to the heart of the matter with me, John White. As the US presidential election winds down to its conclusion on November 8th, it is clear by now that a major weapon in the Democratic campaign, the Clinton campaign against Trump, has been Russia and WikiLeaks. Russia, a nation of 145 million people with a strong military, can look after itself. But what about WikiLeaks? WikiLeaks is an organisation of volunteers who've played an impeccable role in the last few years in revealing the high crimes and war crimes of the rich and powerful. The human face of WikiLeaks, by now everybody should know, is Julian Assange. Julian Assange is currently ensconced, incarcerated, it would be more accurate to say, in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he's been since 2012. He was incarcerated more or less for 2 years before that. He spent 10 days in Wandsworth Prison, 550 days in house arrest. He is incarcerated. He is a political prisoner de facto. We're going to talk today about Julian Assange. I'm delighted to be joined by a very, very special guest. But before we get to our guest, as ever, Joanna took the streets to find out what the public thinks. Let's have a listen.
Yes, we went out to the streets of Edinburgh to ask people, do you think WikiLeaks is a beacon of truth or a threat to US national security?
That's a bit of a both, really, in my opinion. I think, I think what Assange did is admirable, personally.
I think it makes it possible to be conscious of another side of the story. Just something to be conscious of. I wouldn't base anything on it. But it just gives you another side to the mainstream media.
It's totally needed. Like, governments shouldn't have to hide information from the people that they govern. Like, at the end of the day, a government serves us, and they shouldn't be keeping information from the people that they serve, if you see what I mean.
Well, that based on the what is reported in fact, and I didn't follow his reporting, and I just listening from the news, so I couldn't be accurate in my answers. Yeah, that's the problem.
I think those two definitions are quite sort of opposing. I see it in like, I don't think it's a beacon of truth, but I think it is valuable in exposing perhaps things that would have gone unseen otherwise.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't like completely say that everything they do is for their, like, I mean, they have the right intentions. I wouldn't say they're always do the right thing by releasing. They could manage it a little bit better.
It depends on what it leaks, basically. I think it depends entirely on the content. Like, if it's things that should be in public domain knowledge, that in hindsight are determined to be public domain knowledge, then it's fine. But if it's something that, you know, seems like it's a threat to national security, then it probably is a threat to national security. So it depends entirely on the context, probably.
Thanks, Joanna. As ever, a variety of views. A lot of confusion, I would say, with regards to WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. I did say I had a very special guest. I was not lying. He is my favourite former British ambassador to Uzbekistan. Indeed, it's right to say that he is my favourite former British ambassador to everywhere. He is a historian, former ambassador, human rights activist, Craig Murray. Craig, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Now, you're a personal friend of Julian Assange, and you are in regular contact with him. How is he? When was the last time you saw him? And what's going on with his case? Because the last I heard that the Swedish authorities, rather, had agreed that they would go to the Ecuadorian embassy to question him on these allegations of sexual offences. But it seems to have all gone quiet since then. What is the situation at present?
I last saw Julian just a week ago. I spent over a couple of hours with him, chatting, discussing the situation. He's fit and well. Obviously anybody is going to suffer a little bit being incarcerated in a small area for a very long period of time, over 4 years now. But he's good. He's doing fine, and he seemed to be in very good spirits. His lawyers and Julian have been trying to get the Swedish prosecutor to interview him in the embassy throughout that four-year period. It was finally fixed for last week, and it's been postponed now. And there's a new date, I think, on the 14th of November, I believe. Exactly what caused the postponement is not absolutely clear, but it does seem like that will be going ahead quite shortly, and we're hopeful that will enable the case to be the case file to be taken to a stage where these rather ridiculous charges will be dropped.
Now, a lot of people have maybe forgotten or don't even realise that the United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention adjudged that he was being incarcerated in violation of his human rights. I have the disposition here. They came to a judgment. They looked at the case and a very detailed judgment. They said, and I'm going to read it directly, the deprivation of liberty of Mr. Assange is arbitrary and contraventions of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It goes on to say that, consequent upon the opinion rendered, the working group requests the government of Sweden and the government of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland to assess the situation of Mr. Assange, to ensure his safety and physical integrity, to facilitate the exercise of his right to freedom of movement in an expedient manner, and to ensure the full enjoyment of his rights guaranteed by the international norms on detention. And they also adjudicated that he is deserving of compensation for what he's been through. Why is Julian Assange not free? What is stopping him being free? I mean, this is preposterous that he is still being forced to be holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in fear of his liberty, not from Sweden, as we all know, but from the United States, which is clearly intent not just on destroying his credibility, but destroying him.
I think that's very true. And I mean, we've had top campaign advisors to Clinton in public on television advocating that he should be taken out by a drone strike, for example. And we know that there's a grand jury procedure against him in the United States to indict him for espionage, which still carries a death penalty. It's worth saying that Julian has always said, and it remains his position, that if Sweden will guarantee that it will not extradite him to the United States on espionage charges, then he will happily go to Sweden to face the legal system there over the accusations that have been made about him in rather strange circumstances. Now, the fact that Sweden is unwilling to do that, and it perfectly well could, extradition decisions are always political, and extradition decisions in Sweden are actually ultimately taken by the justice minister, not by the court.
And they have form in this regard. They've already extradited prisoners at the behest of US and under the rubric of the war on terror and rendition, haven't they?
Julian has every right not to trust Sweden in this regard. And it should be said as well that the United Nations panel consists of extremely distinguished lawyers internationally. I happen to know one of them. And the United Kingdom has never, ever before questioned any judgment of that United Nations panel. There have been hundreds of judgments. And astonishingly, Hammond, when he was Foreign Secretary, stood up in Parliament and actually stated that the members of the panel are not lawyers, which is a complete lie. Absolutely astonishing that the British government reacted to this case, but simply by lying.
Now, to its shame, a large section or a significant section of the progressive movement, so-called, in this country has joined in the demonisation of Julian Assange. They've really done a job on him, haven't they, the British establishment, in terms of undermining his credibility, painting him rather than as a political dissident, as basically a rapist on the run, essentially. Now, how bad has it been for Julian through these past few years? I mean, how is he psychologically? Because I think we're used to seeing Julian when he comes out with his statements on various events and so forth. He seems indomitable. He seems a very robust character. He's certainly very principled in terms of the role that he's played. But on a personal level, how it must be really, really difficult for him in the situation he's in, with really, at this point, no light at the end of the tunnel.
I think it's extremely difficult. There can't be a much worse personal thing to be accused of than rape, because rape is a terrible crime. So obviously, to face that accusation is very difficult. And, you have to realise the CIA know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Because if you choose to try to fit someone up and destroy them, then if you make rape the allegation, you immediately bring into play identity politics. Mm-hmm. And I think this case has been a very good example of the way that identity politics can be used to split the left and split progressives. Because sadly, there are an awful lot of people on the left has taken the view that just because the accusation is rape, therefore you cannot question whether it's true or not.
You're guilty until proven innocent.
Exactly. If it fitted him up, you may remember when, for example, the South African security services fitted up Peter Hain with a bank robbery or post office robbery when he was heading the anti-apartheid.
Covered him in glory.
If they fitted up Julian with a bank robbery, then everyone on the left would have defended him if they'd fitted him up with almost any other crime you can think of. That's why, the security services aren't stupid. That's why they chose rape as the allegation, because it brings identity politics into play. And that's a wider discussion, but I think
it dislocates his support.
It does indeed. And this is part of a much wider picture where neoconservatives are trying to hijack identity politics. And so you see the Clinton campaign being a prime example, where they're playing for the female vote, the black vote, the Hispanic vote, on the grounds that they want to represent or manipulate those identity groups. And yet their policies are extremely right-wing. Neoconservatism abroad, neoliberalism at home, and will do no good to the vast majority of people in those groups at all. But they manage the manipulation of identity. It is a very interesting feature of modern politics.
I think Lenin described it as useful idiots, didn't he?
I think that's a very good way of putting it.
Now, Julian Assange has played a very remarkable role in world affairs. I'd like you to kind of contextualise that role he's played. I'm thinking, as I speak to you now, of the infamous footage of the Apache helicopter gunship in Iraq that slaughtered a group of civilians, innocent civilians, some of them Al Jazeera journalists. I think there was an Al Jazeera cameraman and journalist involved, whilst the pilots and the gunners and the crew were actually glorying in the slaughter as if they were at a ball game. Now, until WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, as I say, the human face of WikiLeaks, revealed that footage, we had an idea of what was going on in Iraq, but we didn't really know how bad, how brutal it was. I wonder if you could, as I say, contextualise the role that Julian Assange has played, and bearing in mind he's part now of a holy trinity, I would think it's fair to say, of dissidents involving and comprising him, Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning, who's currently languishing in a US military prison. What role, what's the significance of the role that Julian Assange and all those other dissidents have played, and what service have they done to us or for us?
I think whistleblowers have become extremely important in the West because the propaganda model, as Chomsky put it, has been reinforced to the extent where otherwise people just don't get any true information out of the media at all. And the ability of images to break through in the way that those provided by Chelsea Manning to WikiLeaks broke through really has made a fundamental change in public opinion on the war in Iraq. It really made a huge difference. It's worth saying, if you like, that Julian Assange and WikiLeaks are publishers. Mm-hmm. They publish what whistleblowers leak to them. And Chelsea Manning, of course, should never be forgotten because she is a real hero.
Yes.
And she has been enduring
solitary confinement for
again and again, and constant harassment and humiliation, being stripped naked, all this kind of thing happening to her in prison all the time with military guards, going through absolute hell. And Chelsea Manning, she should be remembered as really a great hero of our times.
Okay, we'll leave it there for a short break. Join us in the second half of the show, where I'll be continuing my discussion with Craig Murray on WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, and all things to do with political dissent.
Hard facts.
We have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy.
Hard facts.
Welcome back to the show, Hard Facts. I'm sitting here with Craig Murray. Now, Craig, in the first half of the show, we discussed Julian Assange and the role he's played. Now, that role has come to prominence again in the context of WikiLeaks as part of the US presidential election. And the Clinton campaign, as I mentioned in my introduction, has really tried to weaponize and in terms of trying to deflect from the actual facts of the tranches of emails that have been released that could really kind of point a harsh light on Hillary Clinton's record, on the Clinton Foundation, or her role in Libya, and the fact that she is, I think it's fair to say, a swivel-eyed warmonger. I think everybody who understands the issues at play here that can cut through the obfuscation and the smokescreen that's been placed around Trump. Certainly, I'm no fan of Donald Trump. But when we get to the hard facts, the policy, ideology, I think we have really a lot to fear from a Clinton presidency. I don't think it's any exaggeration. Now, they're trying to claim that WikiLeaks is essentially an agent of the Russian government. I think even on the level of logic, that's ludicrous. What do you think?
WikiLeaks has never published any material received from the Russian government or from any proxy of the Russian government. It's simply a completely untrue claim designed to divert attention from content of the material. You know, people are saying, look at all this material. The Clinton organization is hideously corrupt, which is revealed in the material. It's affecting foreign policy in exchange for donations to the Clinton Foundation, which is revealed in the material. It's fixing the democratic primary process against Bernie Sanders, even doing things like leaking photos of Bernie Sanders in his swimming trunks to the media. Really nasty stuff, you know. And all that is simply being answered by, oh, no, it's Russia. You know, that's a quite extraordinary and ridiculous riposte of this material. But, I mean, I can tell you absolutely for certain that the material is not coming from Russia.
It strikes me that these accusations of Russia's involvement and interference in US internal affairs is a form of projection, in as much as the US is a country that is used to and has a long history of interfering in the internal affairs of other countries all over the world, Latin America, the Middle East, Africa, so forth. Do you get that sense that this speaks to the insecurity and the weakening of American democracy? I mean, at home, it seems to be a social crisis with the polarization on all racial grounds, the massive inequality, relative economic decline compared to China, the fact that it may have the biggest military in the world by far, but it certainly doesn't have the ability to wield this military in a way it would like, the defeats that suffered in Iraq, defeats that suffered in Afghanistan in terms of trying to pacify those countries and reshape the region. Where do you think this kind of narrative comes from, this anti-Russian propaganda, which has reached an unprecedented level? It seems to be they're trying to condition the people in those countries, and obviously we're talking here about Britain also, for a kind of coming Cold War, an uplift in conflict with Russia. Very, very dangerous times, I would suggest. What do you think is driving this? It seems to be a very conscious policy on the part of the US political and British political class.
I think the first thing to say is that, you know, the US election reveals the whole idea of American democracy as a joke. You have two absolutely appalling candidates from the same class of the ultra-rich, with very similar, very right-wing policies, who know each other very well. My favourite fact about the election is the fact that Trump actually paid Hillary Clinton to attend his wedding. Which just shows what awful people they both are. I mean, Hillary Clinton will do anything for money, and Trump's a kind of man who pays people to go to his wedding. It just absolutely... But, you know, they're two sides of the same coin. So there is no real useful democracy in the United States. And what Clinton is doing and what Obama and the US establishment are doing is extremely dangerous in this ridiculous raising of the psychological stakes with all this anti-Russian propaganda, whipping up of Russophobia. I mean, there is no chance whatsoever that Russia is going to ever attack the United States. That simply isn't going to happen, just as Russia isn't ever going to attack the United Kingdom. And for some strange reason, the media goes mad when Russian warships sail past the UK, which they have to do to get to the Mediterranean. But Russia is not actually the enemy of the United Kingdom or the United States. There's no chance whatsoever Russia will ever attack either of those two countries. There never has been a chance Russia would ever attack either of those two countries. But of course, the narrative is all to do with power and wealth and funneling huge amounts of American taxpayers' money into the defense industry and the security industry and the armaments industries. You know, and these people are both from a class that benefits from that.
They benefit from directly from this kind of uplift in Cold War rhetoric and an uplift, the necessity for increased military spending and so forth that comes on the back of that.
Precisely. It's an old story, but it's also an extremely dangerous game, and it feeds into a foreign policy which is completely mad. I mean, in Syria, and I should say I'm no fan of the Assad regime at all. I'm very critical of the Assad regime. But the idea that backing, you know, assorted groups of jihadists to tear the country apart is a better solution. It's crazy, and it's especially crazy when we've already messed up Iraq and Afghanistan, and now we're doing exactly the same thing again. And you can see it doesn't work. I mean, it only works in terms of promoting continued instability and continued spending for the military and the security services. There is no other rationale for it.
Yeah, I think we've reached a stage where I think it's inaccurate to describe it as a Syrian conflict. I think it's a conflict taking place in Syria, but it has a wider geopolitical component to it. Now, we've talked about Julian Assange, we've talked about WikiLeaks. I would like if you could tell us a bit about your own story. I mentioned at the start that you are a former British ambassador, a long career in the British diplomatic service, but you turned. Now, everybody understands that being an ambassador is a very, very high status position in Britain. I'm assuming it comes with a nice compensation financially, status, you're essentially a pillar of the establishment and so forth. So it must have been a massive, massive decision for you. Or was it a massive decision? What was it that prompted you to turn against everything that you had held dear up to that point and become a dissident in your own terms and a human rights activist and a staunch opponent of the British establishment?
I should say on a personal basis, it was very difficult. And suddenly to discover that, you have to do washing up, and that when you take off your underpants before you go to bed and drop them on the floor, they don't magically wash themselves. to sort of lose the servants and the lifestyle was difficult. No, I was horrified to discover, in effect, the Extraordinary Rendition Programme, to discover that Bittam was, knowingly obtaining intelligence, God, from terrible torture, from rape, from asphyxiation, from burning, from boiling, from smashing of limbs. Dreadful, dreadful torture. And we were conniving and getting intelligence from it. And the intelligence was bad intelligence anyway. It wasn't good information. Even if it had been good information, it would have been totally immoral and illegal. And also, I had been head of the FCO section that monitored Iraqi attempts at weapons procurement. So I knew for certain that the lies about Iraqi WMD were just that, were lies, and that the government knew they were lies. So I simply found myself in a position where I was morally unable to continue doing my job. It was as simple as that. So in the end, although it was, as you say, to fall out of the establishment in the UK, you fall out with a bump. You're never going to work again, that's for sure. They make certain of that. And it was very, very difficult. But I don't feel like I really had a choice. Once I discovered what was happening, I just wouldn't have been able to sleep at night if I'd gone along with it.
How do people sleep at night who continue to work for the British establishment, knowing what you know? I mean, you're one of many. What is it that compels people, that keeps people in line, that stops them? I'm assuming that everybody has a conscience. How do they solve that conscience? How do they justify continuing in those roles? Do they think they're working for a greater good? Are they so imbued with an ideology? What is it that makes them continue to remain in post when they see these, or they come across these high crimes?
It's quite interesting. I mean, I used to believe in what I was doing, and I believed the British state was a force for good, and to discover it wasn't was quite a shock to my worldview. I think an awful lot of the Foreign Office, well, I know for certain, an awful lot of people, very senior people in the Foreign Office, sympathised with me very much and told me so. Very few other people would resign over it or gave up over it. I think undoubtedly morale was affected, and people mostly convinced themselves by what I call the democracy lie. They said to themselves, Bittam is a democracy, the government makes a policy, I'm just a civil servant, so I'm only doing my job.
You remember that, where people will do anything as long as there are being authority. The sort of Eric Fromm writes about that, about the bureaucratic mentality, how they're even many, in many ways, more cruel than the actual person that's ordering them to carry out these heinous acts.
That's true. But the interesting thing is, these are people who are not low-level functionaries. These are top diplomats paid hundreds of thousands of pounds a year who, are meant to be able to determine policy and think for themselves. And they're still making these excuses for themselves, which is a sad facet of human nature.
So you kind of came to the fore during the whole sort of post 9/11 era with rendition, the war on terror and stuff. And the last prisoner, I think, is very symbolic in Guantanamo. And he's been described as the most tortured prisoner in the history of Guantanamo, has just been released without charge. That strikes me as a very symbolic kind of moment. It speaks to the fact that the whole case, post 9/11 kind of architecture was built upon, about the war on terror and you're either with us or against us, and rendition and torture and so forth. It really is a dark chapter in our history, isn't it? No one is yet to pay a price for that. None of the main players, Tony Blair, George W. Bush, Alistair Campbell, all the rest of them who've been identified as being key in the lies and the dissembling and so forth that were used to make the case for the war, have ever been brought to account. That has to happen, surely, hasn't it?
I'd love to see it, but I think without a real change in the power structures in the West, it's not likely to. The only person from the CIA who was jailed over CIA use of torture was a chap called John Kiriakou. I presented an award to him in Washington 2 months ago, and John Kiriakou was jailed for blowing the whistle on CIA torture. The people who did the torture have suffered no comeback at all.
The champions of truth are punished, and the enablers of abuses of power are awarded and go off into the sunset with riches and fat pensions. A very despicable state of affairs, and it points to the fact, as I've said many times, that what we describe as democracy is in truth organised hypocrisy. You've been listening to Craig Murray. What can I say? Craig, do you have a website that people can catch up with your work on? I know that you're very busy. You've just published a book. Tell us something about that, please.
Yeah, I've just brought out a new book, which is called Secunda Burns, and it's a biography of Alexander Burns, who died in the First Afghan War. And if you like, it's an example of the folly of how Western foreign policy repeats itself again and again and again, and we make precisely the same mistakes. I think it's an interesting read. My website is craigmurray.org.uk.
craigmurray.org.uk. Make sure to check it out. Thank you for listening. Please join us next time when we'll be discussing more hard facts.